All right, guys, before we jump in, I want to tell you real quick about the 0 to 100 Elite Mastermind. This is our own high-level group for serious real estate investors looking to scale fast. Inside, we share deals, strategies, and we build real relationships all to grow our cash flow portfolios. And you know what? Most members actually add 10-plus units in their first year. Plus, you'll get exclusive access to our podcast guests for direct Q&A. If you're chasing time freedom through real estate, check it out at 0to100tribe.com. That's Z-E-R-O-T-O, the number 100, tribe.com. Now, enjoy the show.
Liquidity is so much more important than interest rates. They, like, the whole discussion about the Fed is a joke. The Fed could rock our fucking world if they stopped buying bonds tomorrow, and they'd rock it by three if they started selling their bonds. So liquidity is much more important than interest rates. Take advantage of the interest rates.
Being on some chips, we go 0 to 100 real quick.
Welcome to the 0 to 100 podcast. I'm Travis Dillard, and we're all about scaling a cash flow real estate portfolio from 0 to over 100 units and achieving your retirement number one, or R1. That's where passive income from real estate replaces your day job and gives you complete time freedom, which is the new currency of the rich.
I'm Mitchell Lehman, and I'm thrilled to have you on board. With our combined real estate holdings valued over $100 million, learn from us and others who achieve time freedom through cash flow real estate.
This is Gabriel Hamill. Here at 0 to 100, you will not hear us talk about house flipping, spec homes, wholesaling, or land banking. We are only about achieving time freedom through buying and holding cash flow real estate. So remember, if R1 is the destination, real estate is the vehicle, and cash flow is the gas. Now go out there and buy some cash flow real estate.
What's up, guys? Thank you guys for joining. For those that are new, 0-100 Tribe is all about helping you get from literally where you are, whether that's zero or a couple units to 100 plus units. The 100 is just a number, guys, but we decided on 100 because I think it's intimidating for a lot of people. I know it was for me when I was first starting out, and it sets a big goal. It sets a big vision. And you get around people who have done it or who are doing it. And it's like we all together as a tribe can move in that direction. So the five pillars: mindset, education, deals, capital. So capital being investors or your own capital or hard money or wherever that money's coming from, right? And then operation, dial in your operations. So we talk about these five pillars often. This is what we're built on inside the tribe. And that's how we progress from coming in here brand new and going, what's this all about, to someday looking back and going, hey, I've got 50 or 60 or 100 units ideally. Lastly, the most important thing for us and our tribe and kind of the way we believe, the way we think, is time. It's not sticks and bricks or mobile home parks or any of that sort or any of that stuff. We want our time back, right? And so we feel like that's the first domino. And so we focus on that. We focus on cash flow inside the community. We focus on the concept of scaling and getting your time back, because I feel like that's the first domino for all the other good things in life: health, wealth, relationships, travel, whatever that is, whatever you dream of doing. We need our time back. So that's what our community is about. Today, Gabe and I are going to interview Mike Ness, and I'm going to hand over the mic to Gabe to give a quick intro, and we'll jump in. Gabe, why don't you take away, man?
Yeah. Hey, what's up, guys? Welcome to the call. It is my absolute pleasure to introduce Mr. Mike Ness. I am fortunate enough to have and consider Mike a good friend. I know a lot of Mike. He is a real estate investor, seller finance specialist, real estate ninja, teacher, educator, and Oregon native. Mike's had projects in small-scale development, both single-family, multifamily, historic preservation, and land development, 20-plus years with appraisal experience, and been investing since 2005. And that's the same time I bought my first house. Mike is the founder of Rare Bird Acquisitions, Rare Bird Real Estate Brokerage, and Rare Bird Property Management. All in all, Mike is one badass dude, and we're all fortunate to have him on this call. So, Mike, welcome to 0 to 100.
Yeah, such a pleasure. Thanks for the invite, guys. Appreciate the time.
Yeah, Mike, thank you so much for being here, man. I've heard Mike speak in other places, and I feel like it's a huge honor to have you here and jumping in. But with that being said, I love starting in the beginning, and I think it's fun because a lot of people in this community are at the beginning, right? They're going, hey, how do I jump into this? And so maybe, Mike, maybe start us out with, like, a little bit before real estate. What were you doing? And then what was your, like, aha, like, hey, I want to go into real estate and do this thing full time?
Yeah, I was fucking around in school, trying to play sports, wasn't good enough to actually get a scholarship out of it, didn't know what I wanted to do. So I was playing catch with the baseball in the backyard with my uncle, and he's like, you should work for me. And he was an appraiser at the time I was in high school. And so I had no, like, idea to go into real estate. And I was interviewing Aaron Belke. I think a lot of Aaron Belke, and he mentioned to me is like a lot of people have their future selves introduced to them in life. And at some point in our life, we then find out what our future selves are and we strive for it. It was no different for me, right? Like becoming a real estate appraiser was just introduced to me by my uncle. Getting into real estate investment and development was introduced to me by a guy I met on an appraisal, an off market 80 acre purchase out in wine country out in here in Oregon. And the way I approached him, the way I approached the job, the way I just approached being professional at 21 years old, he invited me out to breakfast one day, gave me Rich Dad Poor Dad. And then that's how I started my real estate investing journey. And so again, that was just another iteration of someone introducing me to my future self and going down that road. My uncle's not a great human being to work for, not a quality human being altogether. And so I just started my own company, right? Like I had a skill set, I had a license, I had a book of business, had a reputation. And so the next best thing was to start a business. And then the real estate crash came. I learned a good portion of the things that you shouldn't be doing that mainstream education kind of teaches you on how to get into real estate investment. So I went from essentially no net worth to pretty close to becoming a millionaire and then like negative $1 million of debt. Or just real estate crash and all that BS that happened, which was a dream. And all that happened between 97 and 2009. And then essentially like in 2010 is when I decided to take it seriously and look into it as like my future, what I actually wanted to become.
Before the real estate crash, you were investing. Is that right? And you said, you said the crash was pretty like you lost a lot. It sounds like.
Yeah, like I'm always told that appraisal, what a great skill set to get into investing. And honestly, it's like this brain you had to break. So all my purchases, six or seven of them prior to the crash were just, they weren't great deals. I was an appraiser. It's like, hey, it's worth 250 and you got it for 180. Not a bad deal, not a great deal, not a change your life deal, right? And all the stuff that I had bought was because I had really good income. I had really good credit. And I saw that there was equity there, or I believe there was future equity. But it was no real actual cash flow analysis, just like most newbies, right? It's like, hey, the mortgage is $2,500, it rents for $2,800, we're good. And we all know that those numbers are not good numbers, right? And so, and the biggest thing is, so your cash flow negative right from the get-go, that puts you in a bad position. And what transpired was so unique in 2008, 2009 is the rental market dropped when the for sale market dropped. Very unique scenario. That stuff rarely happens at the same time. You think about it, is because, well, people were staying in the house, they weren't paying the mortgage, but they also didn't have to go rent anything, right? And so you had this demand just not in the rental market. So I had negative cash flow, extended vacancies. Now you can't sell your property. And I made stupid decisions. Like one of the properties that I bought was a new construction townhouse. I put the offer in before, like 60 days before they broke ground. My purchase was 240, is worth 300 when it was done, or 320 when it was done. But my accountant's like, you're going to pay a $40,000 tax bill if you sell it. I didn't look at the $40,000 gain. I looked at the $40,000 tax bill and I held a negative cash flowing rental property. Yep. Right. And so it's just that realigned me to understand you're not buying for equity. What are the fundamentals that create sustainability in this industry?
Mike, at what point did you change your investment philosophy? At what point did you realize, you know what, shit, I've been investing for equity, which you can make a lot of money. You can build a lot of wealth through long-term appreciation, obviously. And you and I have talked about this a lot, cash flow, mm-hmm. appreciation, net worth, all that stuff. But at what point were you like, oh my gosh, I still want to do this? Because some people get burned and they're like, I don't want to buy another property. And you obviously took the path of like, hey, I still want to build wealth through real estate. There's got to be a different way. So how did you change that philosophy of like, okay, I'm going to invest, it's going to be cash flow. Like what was the turning point in your mind?
Yeah, like actually the answer is creating a philosophy. And I love this. Like I get told a lot, I'm pretty smart. I know all that bullshit, right? I'm the biggest I don't know. I didn't have a philosophy. I just got in, I got started and I really didn't know what the hell I was doing. And so what changed my philosophy was creating a philosophy, which comes through education, right? And that's one big reason I'm so big on education and mentoring and like building tribes and building communities and building relationships, because that is so, at the end of the day, that's the most rewarding portion about it for so many more reasons, right? There's the giving back aspect. There's the reciprocity aspect. There's the karma aspect. There's so many things about it And I think education truly is the fundamental, and in experience as well. So the more experience you have, you learn. And I love this model, which we learned through GoBundance, which is this four cycle of learning. First, you don't know what you don't know. Then you know what you don't know. Then you have to go gain the knowledge that you know you need to gain. And then once you have that knowledge, then you go right back into that cycle of you go into a higher level of education. You don't know what you don't know. You find out, right? And so that comes through experience. That comes through education. It comes through networking and all that. So the answer to your question is just I didn't have one and finally gained one over a period of time.
How important has that played in your business, that social capital, building genuine relationships? We talked a lot about the difference of transactional relationships versus genuine relationship. How big of a piece has that played in your investing and just in your life in general?
You know, I'll use an analogy that I was thinking about just a couple of days when I was driving is like anyone who's been in business, the same business or has run a business for 10 years has a lot of amazing things to share. And they may not be good at doing and communicating, but they've got amazing things to share. You know, a guy who's like started and stopped and sold business, like there's a difference between those two human beings, right? The person I like is that 10-year business owner. It's based on fundamentals. It's based on relationships. They're obviously sustainable. They're building long-term things versus the start and stop. The lack of foundation, in my opinion, is the relationships. It's the integrity. It's the honesty. It's keeping people around. Like I look at my real estate career and I think I've got like 3 burned bridges. One of them was by my choice. 2 of them were other choices over a 20-plus year career. It's a really long time in a very small community to meet a ton of people and not burn big bridges, right? Like at the end of the day, there's no reason to burn anything down. You want to build a relationship that's going to be the lifeblood of your community. And if you focus on that, everything else follows. Like success is really just a byproduct of strong relationships. And that can be anything in life, business, parenting, marriage, friendship, father, daughter, son, sister.
I love that. Mike, first of all, I trust you more having gone through 2008. You talk to people who, and it's not bad, it's just when they got in the game, but like started in 2012, but it's just been up and to the right the whole time. Like that could change your philosophy over time or your perspective. And now they're going like, what's going on in the market? This is insane. You're like, well, the market can go both directions, right? It doesn't have to go up all the time. Now, traditionally, over the long term, it tends to go up, but like, I love that you've been through that and you're honest about that. And unlike a lot of people, you're not blaming people. You're taking responsibility and going, look, I messed up. And I'm the same way. I bought speculative stuff before 08. I thought I was a genius until 08. And then I wasn't a genius. Oh, look at that. Mm-hmm. So maybe talk a minute about your investment philosophy. And I know that the school hard knocks is part of that foundation of that philosophy, but maybe talk about like the way you look at things now.
Yeah, well, and this is where like Gabe and I are so aligned is like, we don't argue about cash flow. We don't argue about equity. You can have both, right? And that's what I want to do is I want to be sustainable in any of the acquisitions that we do. You're typically going to evaluate that lens through equity or expandability or forced appreciation or cash flow. But my investment philosophy is like, I want to be a transactioneer. I really look at economics. I look at real estate transactions like an engine, like a mechanic, right? So I want to just know how all those pieces work, how they're supposed to work, how they're supposed to contribute to that overall smooth running engine. And then if something isn't working right, where does that cause stress somewhere else? Mm-hmm. And if you can kind of look at the economy as from an engine standpoint or a transaction like an engine, all the mechanics, then you bring different tools to the table. You solve different problems with the different types of tools that exist. So like my mindset or philosophy with investing is really building a really big tool belt, communicating face-to-face with property owners or at least decision makers on those properties, and then being so good with your tool belt, which tools to bring out and discuss in those conversations. And you know which tools to leave in the toolbox. And so it creates efficiency. Like 2009, 2010, I was just a blunt object, right? I didn't have, my credit was shot. I didn't have cash. I cashed out my 401k to buy a $26,000 education package. And so wholesaling and flipping were all I knew. And I was a blunt instrument negotiating stuff in living rooms. And you look at who I am now, that's like the really good example of no philosophy. I need to make a buck versus me now, which is, I've got a lot of experience. I got a lot of skills. I just want to make sure that the right tool is being used for the owner to make sure that they're happy. At the end of the day, if you make enough property owners, you benefit enough property owners, you'll benefit on the end yourself.
I like I love how you like identified a philosophy. In my, I have this theory, like whether it's a philosophy or a checklist in your business or a process or a goal or your big why or whatever that is, define that. Because once you put clay on the table, you can mold the clay now. But a lot of people go throughout life without identifying something, like the investment philosophy, for example. What is your philosophy? And write it down. And then you can go back to that and say, hey, I learned something. Let's tweak this. Let's tweak this. And over time, you get better at that. We've done that in our business forever. Like our process is, it started on a piece of paper. Hey, how do I close a property? Okay, here's my process. And then over time, I'm going, hey, this kind of sucks. Let's change this. But at least there's clay on the table.
Yeah, it doesn't have to be stagnant. I love that you said that. It's like your philosophy really shouldn't be stagnant at all. It should be something that you refine and change based upon all the experiences you get.
Mike, a question I have for you. What advice would you give the younger investor, not younger in age, but just a newer investor? Maybe they haven't bought their first investment property. Maybe they own a couple properties and looking to scale. What would you tell the newer investor that's like, hey, I want to go build some wealth. I want to be financially free. I want to reach that first level of financial freedom, replacing my income with real estate. What kind of advice would you give those folks?
Yeah, well, I think the first thing I'd say is be hopeful. This is a once in a lifetime opportunity that you're getting into as a new investor. And we've all talked about all this stuff. We're going to see the biggest wealth transfer we've ever seen in our history. At the same time, the interest rates are really high. The interest rates are pretty prohibitive to getting a deal that makes sense for you as a buyer and makes the seller happy at a time where the sellers and the liquidators of those real estate probably acquired them through seller financing. So they understand the structure of seller financing. So first off, be really hopeful and don't let the current market conditions get you down, because like we've seen this over the past few years, as it becomes easier to sell a property, it becomes harder to buy a property, and the vice versa happens, right? When it becomes harder to sell a property, it becomes easier to buy a property. And guess what we're in right now? We're in this window of it's hard to sell a property, it's easier to buy. And we were in this window last year and it swung back. And we're in this really window where literally every 2 to 3 months, every quarter, it's going to swing back from easy to sell, hard to buy, easy to buy, hard to sell. And acquisition is a long game. It's a snowball. It's momentum. And so you can build relationships up right now. Like our first purchase after the demand crash in 2022 is one of our best purchases in a long, 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 long time. It was an offer I made in January of 2019, so pre-COVID, pre all that stuff. And it was an offer based on land value because the owner wouldn't let us see the house. And then August 2022, he calls. He's like, is that offer still good? Right? And if you plant those seeds now, in 6 months, 12 months, 18 months, 24 months, those relationships will build. So A, great time to start that journey, because your access to sellers right now is better than it's ever been. Like your response rate on marketing right now, ask any investor who does marketing, their response rate right now is better than it's been in the past 10 years. And why is that? Because it's difficult to sell a property. You can't really go to the market. Realtors are getting out of the business. Not the best time to use a realtor. So what does that mean? Sellers are willing to have conversations with the buyer directly now. So really great time of opportunity. The other thing is I like take Dylan out to lunch. Like the guy's a beast. He just goes and talks to property owners, right? He's getting a finder's fee. He builds a relationship. I think it's a great example of how this started. Dylan has experience. He doesn't have a significant amount of experience. He's not afraid of what he doesn't know. He goes and takes action. He builds relationships. I see the guy everywhere I go. He talks to buyers. He talks to sellers. He talks to property owners. You get a finder's fee here. You get a mobile home park that he's partnered on here. Now he wants to go fly over to the other side of the country, right? It's all driven really by relationships, building relationships with people that have or are doing what he wants to do. Do that. There's nothing better to do than that.
Love hearing you say that.
I'm like taking notes as I go here, because I'm like, there's so many ahas. You talked about like when deals are hard. I talk to people all the time. I'm like, look, there's a lot of other things that you should be doing. Yes, we always want to be looking for deals. We haven't bought a deal in a while. I also think being a good investor means that you're patient. You look at Warren Buffett. He plays sniper. He waits a long time and he looks for deals all the time. But when he buys, it's very impactful. Like you said, there's a lot of things you can be doing to prepare yourself for when deals are great, for when you do find deals. And so like, you know, your education, your relationships, your mindset, what are your operational, what are your processes in the background? Like how are you going to go close a property? Investors, if you want to bring in investors someday, if you're at that point. Like I think that people just look at this as like just deals, and there's so much more to be built And relationships, I think, is the number one piece. Going backwards just a little bit, you talked about the biggest wealth transfer. Maybe talk about what that is and what that looks like to you, as well as like why this is happening.
So this is interesting. If you, it's going to take us 3 hours.
Mike's getting excited about this topic.
I'm here, Mike. All day for you, brother.
Well, just like how you analyze things, we all understand the concept of realized gains, right? And this may be helpful. It may just be a complete distraction. I apologize if it is. But think of a baby boomer who's going to sell their real estate, right? If they sell their real estate prior to a 20% real estate correction, that equity is real, right? They sell it at 500K instead of 400K, and they liquidate that $100,000 is now realized, and that is real. And then that reverberates through the economy, right? So they sell it, they liquidate that paper equity. That paper equity is now cash, probably going to be reinvested into assets or paid off debt or some faction, right? If a real estate market in that scenario, say they sell after the crash, they sell it for 400K, they lost that 100K of value. More importantly, if you stack that up times 100,000, 10,000 owners, that reverberates through the economy, right? So selling prior to a real estate crash is very inflationary for the overall economy. Selling after a crash is very deflationary or disinflationary for economy. And so I kind of look at all those things. What's really amazing, what's happening right now, is we have the biggest amount of real estate sellers coming to the market ever, the baby boomers. At the same time, we have the next largest generation behind the baby boomers entering the home purchasing field. And so when we talk about inventory, we talk about supply levels, why has the real estate market not crashed? Because we're bringing supply at a time when demand is still there. And so we have this crazy time. Like, if think about it this way, if the millennial generation was not a huge generation, a huge demographic consuming glob of demand, and now you have this wealth transfer, which is a lot of it is sales oriented. Now you're bringing in supply into a less demand market that dilutes values. That's not a very good thing. We're seeing the complete opposite right now. And so when we talk about the wealth transfer, it's a lot of things. What's really interesting right now is baby boomers are really freaking lucky. What do they like to invest in? Bonds, income portfolio, right? Like if you go to Vanguard, like they'll tell you their different stock allocations, and an income portfolio, which is essentially a baby boomer, is 100% bonds, right? Even better, municipal bonds, so they don't pay any taxes on them. Well, the yield on those are 2 to 3 times what they were literally 18 months ago. And so baby boomers haven't lost any value to their portfolio for the most part. They've gained it back what they've lost. They have better income than they had because the yield and the dividends of their portfolios are paying off more. So they're sitting in this real, this good place of less stress. And that portfolio that will eventually get passed down to the heirs isn't losing value. And so that maximizes the amount of wealth that will get transferred. And then we think about how does it get transferred. Think about the mindset of the millennial, or even, I'd say not even the millennial, I'd say like, I'm 44, you look at the people that are 44 to 55, 45 to 60, they don't want to own real estate. They weren't taught that. And think about the baby boomers, what were they? Grew up in a very racist community, a sexist orientation. They did it by themselves. They didn't want their wives involved. A lot of times they didn't teach their children. And we see this all the time in these estates that we go through where their children don't have any idea what to do with the real estate. They don't want anything to do with the real estate. The dad dies. Mom gets stuck with 20 keys, 3 doors. They don't know what the heck they're doing. And so there's no solution for that problem inside the family. The solution comes to us as real estate buyers. And the opportunity then comes to us as real estate buyers. That's a big rant. I don't know if there's any value in that.
Like, you wonder why people think you're so smart. You have a lot of knowledge in that brain of yours. And every time I hear you speak, I'm just like, shit, this guy knows a lot about a lot. With this transfer of wealth, where do you see this younger generation not necessarily wanting to buy properties, not necessarily wanting to own homes? I think that it's not as appealing as it once was, this so-called sold idea of an American dream and being attached to a mortgage for 30 years. Where do you see that coming into play with this next large group of humans getting into adult age?
Yeah, I think what is you see more of a lifestyle renter, and especially when you see the advent of like midterm rentals and Airbnbs and all that stuff, you create a market or you create the environment where someone can be a lifestyle renter. And I think we'll see that, and we'll see increased more of it. But what I also see that we didn't really, and why I said like people 45 to 60 that don't want to own real estate, like I never wanted to own real estate, it just dropped in my lap. We didn't have social media. We didn't have own this, own that, own this, shoved down our face our entire lives. There's kids that are younger, right? And they've been told since they were 12, entrepreneur. One of the reasons, like one of my thought processes on like low income jobs and service oriented jobs, one of the reasons we're struggling filling those jobs isn't because people are afraid of COVID, it's because they don't want to work. They want to be entrepreneurs. They want to be owners. They have an investment mindset, not a tenant mindset, right? There's a difference between an owner mindset and a tenant mindset, or an investor mindset and an employee mindset. And I think social media is really pushing people in that direction. And so maybe we have less personal residence ownership. I think that will be offset by more investment ownership demand. So I don't think it's really going to change the marketplace so much. I think where you'll see it is in the types of investments that are owned, the types of properties that are rented, and then these different little sub-markets that are created.
On the subject of entrepreneurship, do you think entrepreneurs are born or they're made? Like, do you believe that there's these purebred entrepreneurs? Like, I know for me, I wasn't going to have a job. I wasn't going to work for anyone. There was nothing. If I lost it all, I'm still not going back to work. I'm going to build something. Do you believe that you're either born an entrepreneur, or do you believe you can make yourself into one?
I think it's a bit of both, but more born, right? Like you can get forged into becoming an entrepreneur, but in that scenario, you're a unicorn and you're going against the grain of your spirit and your DNA. Like I'm like you, I was never going to work for anyone. I just never felt like that was the route. I've had two jobs in my life and I've had more companies than jobs. So I do think you're just born with it, because essentially what is an entrepreneur? You've got leadership skills, you're willing and independent enough to go at it your own, you're willing to take risks. Like the skills that really make people a quality entrepreneur are pretty unique in this world, in my opinion. And so I don't think people look at like, if you're not, like if you're risk averse, it's got to take a lot to turn you into someone who welcomes risk. And so you have to truly be committed to getting that. And I don't think that's a learned. I think that's like a bullheaded, I'm going to do this type thing. I think most of the skills you're born with.
That's a good point. Yeah, I love that. I think it's funny because I talk to my friends all the time about what I do. And when I talk to you guys, like 0 to 100, I feel normal. But I go to coffee with a buddy and he's like, bro, you're on a different planet. I'm like, got it. Like, I don't fit in. I fit in with the tribe, but I don't fit in with many other people. So go back.
I was looking at there real quick. Mitch, I think it's an important thing to say to this group, because I think that is the conversation a lot of us have as we're getting started. All my friends told me the same thing. Mike, your friends probably told you the same thing. They think you're absolutely crazy. They think it's risky. I remember thinking, getting a job is really fucking risky. Like trying to work for the next 30, 40, 50 years of my life and somebody else having the authority and ability to say, you know what, you're done. We don't need you anymore. That seems way riskier. So I think groups like this, it's important to be around people that inspire you, that push you, that don't think that your dreams and goals and what you want to do is just a bunch of bullshit and risky craziness.
100%. Before I jumped off the entrepreneurial bridge, I worked for a company where I was super stressed. I was working all the time. It was a med tech company, you know, and I was in my 20s. A guy who was 37 years old had a stroke on the job. And it was like, he didn't have anything pre-existing, but he's extremely stressed. And we weren't sleeping much and we were working 68 hours a week. And I remember thinking, just like Gabe said, like, what's more risky? I don't understand why you guys don't see this. And this was an extreme example, but like, it was a big moment for me.
The reason people don't see it is we work on these time constraints that aren't useful for us, right? Like we look a lot of times day to day, we look really short at a time span. It's one thing I really love about Alex Hormozi is he just talks so well about if you expand that time threshold on how you analyze things, it changes every way you look at something. One thing my dad did for me that was so amazing was delay gratification. We live in a world of non-delay gratification, really quick, instant dopamine hits. And so we're now trained to really focus on a really small time constraint. Unless we're pissed about what happened in the past and telling ourselves a story about it, or we're worried about the future, right? Mm-hmm. So it's like in those contexts, it's really good to be in a small time constraint. But in most things, you want to expand your time constraint to be able to look at things in a different and more empowering way.
I love it. Yeah, that's really interesting. I also follow Alex Monrosi. I think he's really interesting. Going back for a second to the wealth transfer, do you feel like the theory is we're going from baby boomers retiring and passing their properties to the millennial children who then don't necessarily want to own them? And I'm not talking about maybe single family here, but more like commercial properties. I've seen a lot of millennials who are going like, I just want the cash. And so do you feel like that's also could be a big volume of deals coming straight from millennials who have inherited it?
That is the volume of deals, right? Because there's going to still be a lot of real estate that transfers, and it's not even transferring. Essentially, it's just the beneficiary and the trust is transferring, or it goes from a living trust, right, to a revocable trust. So it's more, so much of the real estate is captured inside of asset protection that stuff won't hit the market. And I'd say the bigger stuff, the bigger portfolios are more in line with that. My favorite market segment is that 5 to 20 in apartment building market segment. The capital isn't there. The big boys aren't playing in it. You have essentially all of your single family investors from the 70s are now 5 to 25 unit investors, right? They just traded those single families into these small apartment buildings, and there really is no exit strategy for them. Most of the commercial brokers, like, if you think about it, like, especially here locally, most of the 5 to 20 unit buildings are listed in our single family residential platform and not CoStar. And there's a reason for that, right? The people that use CoStar, they don't go talk to those homeowners because they're commercial brokers. Those are too small commissions. And then the resi agent who then lists that 10 unit property has no fucking clue what they're doing. And so it's like this amazing market segment to go after. And that's the market segment where unsophisticated sellers, they don't have the asset planning in place. The kids don't want the asset. The kids just want the cash. And so there's going to be transfers of all types of real estate. We've got the commercial world paying and all those things coming. But I think that real sweet spot is being that you're not in the 1 to 4 unit family loan world. You're in a commercial loan product, but the loan amount for that commercial product doesn't get anyone excited. That gets a guy like me excited.
What are you most excited about right now, either personally or professionally?
Mentoring and coaching. That's kind of what my role in our company has really evolved to as well, right? Is like you become a visionary, you get your org chart, staffing chart all filled out. Now your role is really to be a mentor, right? There's things you see and you don't see, but that can extend above and beyond that. So doing more coaching, creating a course, I'm really excited about that. It's where my heart is. It's what I like the most. I think I have a pretty unique lens and experience level where I can bring a lot of things to the table. I think I look at economics in a different way. So finding my future self and my vision of who I kind of lean into as a real estate educator isn't like the right word I'm looking for, but going down that road, right? Always have the investments. We'll always have a development company. I'm really excited with where our staff's headed. We're going to make another phase of building out the property management company. That's really rewarding for staff. Seeing our staff own more and more real estate. Like one of our staff members sent me a text the other day. He's like, hey, I'm now a multimillionaire. And I'm like, what? Then he sent another text, in debt, right? So to see a young guy like measure himself and the amount of debt he's taking on in a sustainable way, I was just really excited to see and see all of our staff right now have bought real estate or are buying real estate and expanding. Like one of our guys went from no units to, I think he's got 12 units now in the past couple of years. So that's the ultimate reward in all of this, I think. And then the next phase, I've got a 16-year-old and a 14-year-old that are struggling with their identities and what they're going to be. And I had one of them up in Portland the other day. And for the first time since they were 6, I think I took them to too many dirty homes and just tainted real estate for life for them. But now they're coming back. Well, maybe this real estate thing isn't too bad. So I'm excited about seeing my kids get excited about their future as well.
That's so awesome.
You mentioned debt. Talk about the importance of debt. I used to have the same response. I would tell people, I'm buying more real estate. They're like, well, you're in more debt. It's like, yeah, it's cash flowing debt. I have an investor buddy that always says, I want to see how much debt I can get into. And what he means is cash flowing debt, buying assets with that debt. And obviously real estate's the most leverageable asset on the planet. But again, we're in this weird time where debt's expensive, right? And so with that in mind, what are some practical things newer investors or even seasoned investors can do? And how can they take advantage of the current debt situation, lending situation to where it is today?
Yeah, I love it. Because it's a double-edged sword, right? And people always think of the sword, the side of the sword that serves them, but not the other side. Here's the best part, and I love a little contrast getting into this, is like 90% of the seller finance deals out there are complete bullshit. right? Because and it goes into this discussion about financing. Oh, it's seller financing. That's awesome. Well, no, most seller financing sucks. And there's a reason it's offered to the marketplace, because it's crappy financing. It's not great, right? And so it's not just about getting in financing and getting into debt. It's getting the right financing and getting into the right debt, and making it sustainable. So don't take short-term debt out. Right now, do not take debt out that's less than 5 years long. And if you have to have a five-year balloon, which all commercial notes now, they want a five-year balloon, you insist that you get a 10-year balloon with a five-year reprice, right? The reality is interest is short-term, equity is long-term. Liquidity is so much more important than interest rates. They, like, the whole discussion about the Fed is a joke. The Fed could rock our fucking world if they stopped buying bonds tomorrow. And they'd rock it by three if they started selling their bonds. So liquidity is much more important than interest rates. Take advantage of the interest rates. I had coffee with an investor in Salem the other day. And he's like, man, what are you doing? What are you doing? I'm like, I'm buying rentals, man. It's awesome. He's like, how do you make them work? You make them work at a 7.85% interest only payment. And then when interest rates go back down 2, 3, 4, 5, 10 years from now, you refinance and your cash flow doubles. And the only way to make it work at a 7.85% DSCR loan interest only payment is to have 35% of equity, which means you created 35% of equity to make that loan work, right? So if I can go buy a rental and have a couple hundred grand in equity and no cash flow, but I know when interest rates go back down, that no cash flow is going to go to $400 a month of principal pay down and $500 a month of cash flow, and I still have a couple $100,000 of equity, that's amazing to me. And those deals did not exist until the Fed did what the Fed did and the bond market reacted the way the bond market and mortgage spreads reacted the way mortgage spreads did. And that's a window that opens and closes that we'll probably see open and close for the next 2 or 3 years, if not more. Right? It opened last year. It closed at the beginning of this year. It's open now. It will close again in January or February. It will open again next summer. So you want to set yourself up so your financing expires well beyond those windows. So you can make a decision when that window is open outside of any duress. And I'll go back to my dad. Again, one of the best things my dad taught me, and he's not a real estate guy, but this is the soundest advice ever. Controlling when you sell is the key to success. You control when you sell your real estate, you're going to be fine. When you lose, when you don't do well in real estate, is when you can't control when you sell, aka you have to sell at a time that's not good. Typically, your financing dictates that.
That's amazing advice. I like that. Real estate's still forgiving, knock on wood, right? But if you can hold long term, even a subpar deal that somebody else is paying the mortgage on, it's a net win long term. However, if you're forced to sell, well, that's like a different situation.
It just goes back to those time constraints. How are you viewing or analyzing that?
So, I'm going to ask a question because I think that people are thinking this, and maybe I'm speaking for you guys, but like, it feels like we've had a standoff. Interest rates went up, right? Debt got more expensive. Sellers said, no, my property's still gold. So the sellers aren't selling, the buyers aren't buying because the debt, obviously there's transactions happening, but the volume's dropped in a great way. When do you feel like this thing starts to crack in a way where sellers go, okay, fine. And buyers go, all right, I'll pay a little extra. I'll take on more expensive debt and I'll cut my cash flow expectations. And we see the market free up in a way where we see volume start to enter more of an average state versus a low, very low volume state. Do you have kind of a prediction on that?
We need to contrast this like commercial world, non-commercial world, right? And standoff's a perfect world. In the commercial world, we're in the middle of a standoff, right? A buyer just can't be happy. A seller can't be happy. The only way a buyer and seller are transacting is if the buyer has a certain level of distress and they got to place capital and they found a seller that actually made them somewhat happy in the placement of that capital. Or we have a seller that has to sell and they just decide to sell. And so sales transactions are down across both industries across the board, but it's even more down in the commercial world. And that's going to be even more down for a longer period of time. The standoff, like literally, in the single family world or the 1-to-4 unit world, it was last summer. It stopped. We go in and out of that standoff now. And what it comes down to is essentially affordability or yield. In the 1-to-4 unit world, it's the affordability. We went from the most affordable market to a historic affordability drop. and affordability isn't back, but it's teetering at that level where it makes sense for a buyer and is acceptable to a seller, right? And so interest rates spike up a little bit this summer on top of cyclical demand. Well, now sales transactions die down a little bit more because we're just at too unaffordable. But once interest rates go back down and the season changes, oh, guess what? Right. And so the 1-4 unit world, we're like in a standoff, out of a standoff, end of a standoff, out of a standoff. And I think that's going to go for another at least 12 months, if not 18 or 24. The scary thing in the 1-4 unit world is once interest rates get down to 6%, God forbid 5.5 or 5, values will go flipping crazy. They are going to go crazy. And so my kind of hope is that doesn't happen too soon, because honestly, if you look back and interest rates going up, going from 3% to 7% was the best thing for the housing market in a long time. So we're on a train crash that was going to be very difficult to get beyond.
It's interesting that you just said about single family homes and interest rates going down. And I tend to side with you, Mike. I can't predict the future, but I can sure try. It feels like on the single family side, people are going, hey, I'm not selling because I'm not giving away, giving up a 3% loan to go get an 8% loan. And so the supply has dropped off in a great way, but also buyers are going, hey, like, I'm not going to buy until interest rates go down. But the bench of buyers feels to be growing in a great, in a huge way. And so like you have this pent up demand with a low supply, and then you pair that with builders saying, I'm not going to build because interest rates are too high. To me, it feels like the perfect storm for a single family value explosion in the next like 24 months. It sounds like we're on the same page there.
100%. It's inventory from existing homeowners because they're mortgage builders. While you're going down the road, I was thinking, just watch the builder confidence index, right? Oh. What did it do? What did it do last year? It fucking plummeted.
Right.
Bottom crashed out. And the end of the year, it shot right back up. Why did it shoot right back up at the end of the year? Inventories were down. They're able to reduce their prices and stay profitable. Bond yields were going down. Mortgage interest rates were going down. Inventory was down. Competition was up. Right. And so then the confidence came back. Well, where's builder confidence at right now? It fucking sucks because interest rates are high again because builders are purely commodity driven. And so you nailed it. And I agree. We're going to see a valuation boom in the single family world.
I think we saw a similar pattern in the 08 crash. Now, the 08 crash was for a lot of different reasons. I'm not saying that there's a clear parallel here. However, we saw builders go home. We saw demand grow via buyers on the sidelines. Builders went home, supply fell off a cliff. And once we've hit a new economic cycle, I think the bottom was 2012 timeframe. What did single family do from 2012 to 2022? Basically, it was up and to the right. So anyway, I talk to people all the time. They're going, oh, well, I'm just going to wait to time the market on the single family side. I'm like, be careful, because I don't think you're going to see prices go down.
You got to think of it like a stock trader and dollar cost averaging, right? You have to always be in the market to get that good timing.
That's a good point. And Mike, I was wondering if you could speak to commercial real estate. And what I mean by that is anything 5 units and above residential, or commercial as in it could be retail, it could be mobile home park, anything that might have a commercial loan on it. Now in the 1-4 units, a lot of people locked in low interest, but on 30-year fixed debt. So they're going to still have those 3% loans in 5 years or however long the market takes for the market to correct a little bit. But on the commercial side, you had a lot of syndicators raising capital, buying deals with very slim margins. The market just kept going up and up. You've had a lot of people locked in low interest debt on commercial properties. But as you mentioned, those adjust every 5 years, typically. So we're starting to see some of those loans mature. I've heard stories of people just literally throwing keys back to the bank. So at some point, whether it's this year, next year, as that 5-year maturity comes, they've locked in 3%. Now interest rates are 8%. That property doesn't make sense. How do you see that impacting the real estate market as a whole on the commercial side? And where do you see the opportunity for investors to take advantage of where the market is at that time when that happens?
Yeah. So kind of step back a little bit. So the way the commercial world works, I don't know the exact numbers. I can't remember them. It's been a few months. But we have something like either $3 trillion total dollars of commercial debt, real estate debt, or $5 trillion. And then we have either $1 trillion of it expiring in the next 18 months or $1.5 trillion. So essentially 33% of the dollar volume of commercial loans will mature in the next 18 months. And so the easy thing, the surface level thing to say is, oh my God, the world's going to fucking end, right? Because they're going to mature at a time where interest rates are significantly higher, underwriting is significantly tighter, and the loan amounts that are going to be giving out are significantly lower, right? That's going to put a lot of people in a lot of distress and a lot of pain. reality is it's not putting the entire market in pain. When we talk about $5 trillion of commercial debt on what, 10, 15, $20 trillion of commercial property, right? So you're already talking about a world that's pretty low leveraged. A lot of that $1.5 trillion of debt that's going to turn over is pretty low leverage. And a lot of it's going to be an asset class that they can work themselves out of it. And so what I say is don't just say, oh man, this foreclosure thing, yes, there's going to be distress. Look at who are those owners? How are they going to exit these problems? Who are the banks? Who are the lenders involved? How are they going to exit those problems? And then politically, what's the political will? What's the banking liquidity? So there's so many different lenses to look at this through. We both love the All In podcast and the Republican, I forget his name. He gave a really good example. I have a $15 million building in San Francisco. I have a $9 million note on it. The note's coming due. The bank will offer me a $2.4 million loan. That's going to kill the average person, right? You got plenty of people who are like, I'll just write a check for the $9 million and I'll refinance later. So you have a certain part of people who are just going to throw cash at the problem. And there's a lot of cash on the sidelines. They can do that. Think of it this way. They've got cash on the sidelines. It's eroding at 3, 4, 5, 6, however you want to measure inflation. Or they can go get an interest rate for 8%. They can just write a check and now turn that cash it's eroding into a net positive value, right? So there's a solution to it. One of the other solutions is the lender doing extend and pretend. So a lot of that's happening right now, extend and pretend, which is essentially the lender, it's not a cash flow issue. It's not a financial statement issue. It's a balance sheet issue. A loan that's past maturity date is now a loan in default, which is terrible for your balance sheet. And when you look at how banking regulations happen, now it becomes problematic with the FDIC. So a lender can just extend and pretend, right? If they're fine from a cash flow management standpoint, meaning they can cover their deposits, they've got the reserves met, there isn't a bank run like First Republic and what's happening, well, just extend it. Now you're not in maturity and now you're fine. And like our friends have the Drunk Real Estate podcast. They mentioned it recently. Like, and I heard this for the first time, which is stay alive till 25. And that's a commercial world right now. And it makes sense. And in 2025, rates will probably be a much better environment to refinance in 2025 than it is now. There's going to be properties like the big projects, the really big projects where now you're talking about pension funds, lots of equity, non-recourse debt that are in the office world that have 70% occupancy. And keys are just going back to the bank, right? There's just no scenario to say that. So there's going to be scenarios where keys go back to the bank. What happens in that scenario? Does the bank then take it to the market? Does the bank take it to one of their other clients, right? So I go start networking with all your community lenders at banks and create relationships with them. Say, this is what I'm looking for. If you have this asset, I can buy them out. The other thing I think is going to come into play is syndication was such a huge thing. And so you have equity raised, right? Like the banks aren't necessarily in a bad position in multifamily, for example, where, okay, so maybe values have come down 10%. But if they got 30% of equity through a syndication, the bank's fine. So it's not a banking issue. It's a liquidity issue for the GP. There's going to be lots of ways where other GPs can go in and save other GPs, right? Or syndications can come in and save all the LPs and kick the GP out. So there's going to be other equity buyouts in that scenario as well. So there's a lot of solutions to these potential problems. What I will say this is it's not going to be a foreclosure crisis like 2008, where we have 6 years of foreclosure. It takes 6 years to get rid of that inventory. It's going to come relatively quick. It will result, though, the problem what we're going to see is we're in a standoff in commercial world. So the problem with standoff is the hardest time to value a property is when there's not a lot of transactional activity, right? The easiest valuation out there is a newer subdivision where everything's the same and you got a whole bunch of transactions. 2 to 4 units in Portland is really hard to value because there's just no transactions. Commercial right now is really hard to value because there's no transactions. So values are down. We all know that. We know cap rates are up. But really, what are they? And that's because the transactions that have happened, they've been somewhat distressed, but they're not purely distressed. So what I do see happening is the portion of transactions occurring that are distressed is going to go from 10% to 20% to 30%. Once you get that ballpark where like 30% of your supply is distressed, now everything's distressed. Now cap rates really go up. Now values really go down, which then creates another self-reinforcing conflict with the lending side of it. Now you have less desire to lend in a down market. So there can be this little period of workout. There will be some pain. There's going to be some really good deals to had. Values will go down. I think we're going to see some reallocation of asset class and real estate portfolios and whatnot. But ultimately, it's just a time thing. The economy is not going to die. Like, we're all going to live. So take advantage of those opportunities where they're there. Create the relationships so you can. And always be aware. Like, that's the one thing, is just always be aware of what's happening. I don't base my investment philosophy based on my predictions economically, right? I continue to update myself economically, so that way if we need to pivot in our philosophy and our model, we do that. And that's the beauty of understanding macroeconomics and looking out on further timelines, is you're seeing what's ahead so you can change now for that.
So good, Mike. Honestly, I love listening to you, and I agree on so many levels. Like, the transition, I don't think it's gonna be mayhem, but there's gonna be a little bit of blood in the streets. There's gonna be a lot of wealth transfer, and I think figuring out how to get behind that and catch some of these deals is where we need to focus, right? All the way back to building those relationships like we talked about in the beginning.
I'd also add this. The media is going to make it out to be worse than it actually is.
Good point. And they already are. They're already, you know, but that's clickbait. They're making money on that. Yeah. They're making money on eyeballs, and fear sells a lot better than reporting good news, right? Where can we find you, Mike?
My Instagram handle is rarebird_Mike. And I got back on Facebook for the first time in 2 years. You guys can find me there and send me a message.
Honestly, thank you so much for your time. I know it's really valuable, but I love to just pick through some of these questions and just dive in with you, man, and understand what's inside your brain, because there's so much good stuff. So hopefully we can have you back in the near future. Really appreciate it.
Yeah, I'd love it, man. I really appreciate the opportunity. I love what you guys are doing. It's a great platform, and anything I can do to add value would be desired.